going to start talking, and are you going to have questions after each one of us, or after, wait, let me all finish?
Yeah,
okay. So I'm going to be talking about low-income women's activism, something I've been working with and on for many years. I always like to start with this. People often ask, why don't women organize? Now, maybe in this day and age, we don't ask that question anymore, but it was a very common question until yesterday. So many of you know Alice Kessler Harris. She's a well-known feminist labor historian. And so she suggests that we look at those who have, which is what I've been trying to do. And when we do, we find that women of all classes and races have a long and inspiring record of activism in the United States. And I'm looking just at the United States. Now, despite this long history, the story of this collective action among low-income women remains largely untold. Why is that? Well, there are several reasons. One, for years, the media preferred to cover large events and famous people. So women weren't included. The scholars presumed that most struggles erupted from market exploitation, where historically more men than women were found, and also relied on conceptions of citizenship that ignored that women could not vote until 1920. Women were, in many ways, barred from citizenship, so they didn't see any women there. They studied institutions such as trade unions, political parties that traditionally excluded women. And then they interpreted women's absence from these places as evidence that they were apolitical, and also then failed to look at the spaces inhabited by women, such as women's clubs, auxiliaries, women's occupations, women's unions, networks, etc. So in the end, they depoliticized women's activism and often and regularly delegitimized it as unwomanly, unfeminine. Feminist scholars across many disciplines finally started to bring women into view by defining politics to include the spaces occupied by women, including poor and working class women. I should say that the research on women started with the middle class reformers, basically, and so it took a while to even get to poor and working class women. And once there, we noticed that first to be noticed were women workers on the job, or you say at the point of production. And this group has received the most attention, and I'm talking over the last 10 or 15 years. They also noticed community women and homemakers who pressed their demands on landlords, merchants, and the state at the point of consumption. Then came public assistance recipients who fought for higher grants, more responsive state services. So the resulting research produced many individual case studies that documented this historical record that began to accumulate a record. And helped to correct the long-standing impression that women, low-income women, were not engaged in any struggle on their own behalf. So the work I'm going to be reporting on relates to a book I've been writing for many years. It always gets postponed because other things come along, but it really does. The work does stand on the shoulders of many known, well-known feminist pioneers, because I'm trying to synthesize this long, fragmented history into a cohesive book. So this research began was part of a wider effort of welfare state and other scholars to shift the paradigm. So we wanted to move past the study of middle-class women reformers to studies of activism among workers and even the less studied homemakers or women in the community and welfare state clients. We also wanted to shift the study of women as targets of oppression to women as agents of change. So in my own work, my book, Regulating the Lives of Women, Social Welfare Policy from Colonial Times to the Present, basically took a top-down approach. It looked at how the welfare state shaped the lives of women. So I began, when I got interested in writing about activism, say this, you know, look at it from the bottom up. How did the demands of women shape the state? So that's the overall goal. So I call this book, this work entitled Gendered Obligations. I think it's in the program, The History of Activism Among Low-Income Women in the United States, probably since 1900, but I don't know where it's going to begin at this point because it's going back even further. It focuses on low-income women, both black and white. The middle-class reformers only show up when their efforts intersect with these groups of activists, but the perspective hopefully will be from the low-income women who did not always appreciate the middle-class reformers' interventions on their behalf. I look at economic and racial justice. There are many other issues, but to limit the scale and scope of the book, but also because these were the bread and butter issues that mobilized the low-income women, more so than women's rights, equality with men. These issues were also the first to bring low-income women into contact with the welfare state, which is my area of research, so it all kind of fit together. So what do I mean by activism? I refer to it as collective action among poor and working class women directed towards improving their standard of living by making claims on landlords, merchants, employers, and the state. And as it includes struggles by workers, but also by homemakers, community-based homemakers, and welfare state clients. And of course, some women occupy all three roles. So it examines struggles conducted by women's clubs, auxiliaries, that I mentioned before, unions, networks, and other organizations, whether or not they developed into large-scale protests or whether they became social movements. However, many of the movements that people in this room have studied or participated in would not have survived without the unheralded female foot soldiers who forged links between national organizers in the various movements and local residents. And these women have really received very little notice or credit for their work over the years, especially in the civil rights movement. Now, the activism of this group of women tends to be sporadic, sometimes spontaneous, not always highly organized, not necessarily long-lived. That is until the welfare rights movement changed that. So if some people have, that's another reason this was dismissed. Well, it's not really anything. It doesn't last long. And it's inconsequential. But others see it as a rational and political means of challenging the status quo. The British historian George Roudet, who noted that under certain conditions, such everyday collective action from below may have far-reaching effects and create unanticipated possibilities for change. So that's sort of the inspiration. So what sparks activism among low-income women? So I've sort of conceptualized four contradictions. The gender division of labor, designed to keep women in their place, paradoxically created the conditions for collective action. The conflict between the requirements of profitable economic production, low wages, high unemployment, and successful reproduction, which takes or family maintenance. A clash between the democratic promise of equal opportunity for all and equal treatment of women on the basis of gender, race, or class. And the tension between controlling and liberatory features of the welfare state. So that's what I'm going to do. I use this framework to kind of shape how I look at this history. So the gender division of labor created the conditions for activism by concentrating women in what you might say female places on the job, in the community, and within the welfare state. Now, this was designed to keep women in their place, isolated, but paradoxically created spaces where women could come together, develop shared grievances, organizational capacity, and political consciousness that often bred the opposite. Collective action for social change on the job, in the community, or at the welfare state office. Now, unlike, I said this before, but unlike white middle class women who became active to secure equal rights with men, this group of women tended to mobilize to achieve what I call the gendered obligations, which really refers to making sure that they and themselves and their family and the community have a decent standard of living. That would otherwise, that they need to carry out their caretaking role because there's no money, no resources, they can't do their job in the home and the community suffers. Now, partly I got this idea because if you read about the analysis of trade unionism, you see that it's linked to the development of factories which concentrated people together and put them in a place where they could identify and communicate about their shared grievances. So the gender division of labor, I think, operates in a different zone, but in the same kind of way. And it's also been noted that when racial segregation concentrated people into urban areas and provided the same kind of sort of basis for collective action and consciousness. So you can look at it, race, class, and gender, and how the opposite of what was intended by these exclusionary practices. So if economics of class drove women into the workforce, the gender division of labor on the job shaped their collective action. And here feminists have worked to figure this out. What do we mean by gendered class consciousness? It is different than class consciousness, which is usually implied male consciousness. So words such as trade union consciousness, industrial women's consciousness, working class feminism, phrases that show up in the literature. And women of color added womanism and black women's standpoint. So there's a lot of struggle to try to capture the consciousness of women in different groups. So that's, and then so the workplace. In the community, the gender division of labor clustered women into women's spaces in parks, clubs, laundries, childcare centers, women's associations, where they could, where they talked and shared their concerns about family and community life. Tamara Kaplan suggests that their activism was driven by what she calls female consciousness, which she distinguishes from feminist consciousness, because when they could not feed, clothe, shelter, or otherwise maintain their families, this question of social reproduction and communities, they joined forces to defend household consumption. The welfare state is also a women's space due to the historic privatization of women, the predominance of women among welfare state recipients and workers, and the state's role in providing family support. Again, based on their shared, often oppressive experience in the public welfare office, the unemployment bureau, and with other social welfare services, and I say this, so I teach in a school of social work, some low-income women developed their common grievances, networks, and political consciousness that supported their collective action against the state, and certainly the welfare rights movement is a, you know, the best example of that. Now, I was trying to say, how can I capture all this? And since I'm interested in the welfare state, I'm playing with the notion of calling it all social welfare activism, and you can tell me if you think it's a good idea when we have a chance to talk. But you know, the case studies that I'm drawing on come from a variety of disciplines, almost all, so many social science, sociology, urban studies, anthropology, political science. I mean, a lot of people have dipped into this. So I'm trying to, using the social welfare lens, I thought maybe it might be a good way to bring them together, because they don't, a lot of times if you're, they're discussing something, they're really discussing a policy or a state action that falls under the rubric of the welfare state, even though they are not coming, the scholar is not coming at it from that perspective. But a lot of the case studies are about housing or health or food or other things. And so I'll ask you, you think it's legitimate to give it a name, social welfare activism, because I'm looking particularly at how most of this activism targets the state. So now the second contradiction is the contradiction that fuels activism is the competing demands of economic production and social reproduction. Now, I don't have to tell this group what economic production is, but all I say is that it takes place in a market where companies produce goods and service for profit, and it depends on high prices, low labor costs, high unemployment, and low taxes, among other things. And social reproduction, also referred to in more popular languages, family maintenance or caretaking, takes place in the family and also other institutions like schools and religious organizations and so on. Now, it depends on the opposite of what economic production depends on: low prices, high wages, low unemployment, and government-funded programs. These support social reproduction. So we have a contradiction, because the smooth operation of a profit-driven economy depends on successful social reproduction in the home. The family is expected to produce the workforce of the current and future workforce and so on. But in the normal workings of the economy, and certainly we see that today, it doesn't generate the levels of employment, education, income, health needed to carry out these caretaking functions. So you have a tension between the two that can get people mad. And this tension is also fueled by racism, which also lowers the standard of living, in addition to poor women of color, channeling them into low-paid jobs and into communities where the poor often pay more for just groceries. So when the standard of living falls too far, it may provoke collective action. If this tension leads to a falling standard of living, it may provoke collective action by increasing community and family stress, limiting the caretaking capacity of women, and weakening the productive capacity of workers. So you have a lot going on there that could actually get different family members, but including the homemaker, active. E.P. Thompson reminds us that people become politically active when conditions violate widely held class or cultural norms for what the market should provide. And so reflecting this, U.S. families and communities throughout history have supported workplace struggles for higher wages, better working conditions. They've organized in the community to bring down the cost of food and rent, demanded more benefits and more responsive government programs. And so when the dynamics of the market economy limit women's capacity to fulfill their gendered obligation, the activism is sparked by this conflict becomes highly gendered. Move this along a little bit. The third contradiction is stems from the failure of democracy to fulfill its promise of equal opportunity for all. So I know none of us are surprised by that, but the principal tenet of democracy holds that it promises individuals equal opportunity to compete for success in the market. Yet the United States regularly denied virtually all subordinated groups equal access to full social, economic, and political rights. So the tension between the promise of equal opportunity for all and the constant reconfiguration of institutionalized classism, racism, and sexism, and heterosexism has led various groups to periodically mobilize forces to fight for their forces, might for civil rights, social change. And then it also, one other thing that happened is that low-income women fighting on the economic justice front started to add equal rights for women. Some started to add equal rights for women to their gendered obligations because they began to experience some of the sexism once they became active. The fourth contradiction is the conflict between the regulatory and liberatory aspects of the welfare state. Now, everyone knows that the welfare state has a regulatory function, channeling women into low-paid jobs, penalizing them for departing from prescribed wife and mother roles. However, the welfare state also has the potential to alter the terms of political struggle. First of all, it underwrites social reproduction, which shifts the cost and responsibility of caretaking from women to the state. It also offers an alternative source of income outside the market, which can strengthen the leverage and bargaining power of subordinated groups, so people can engage in collective action if they can get unemployment insurance. It's like a strike fund. It gives you some resources so you can engage in the battle, at least for the time being. And then this will allow these struggles at the point of production, the point of consumption, and with the state. Now, of course, there's always context, right? So this activism is, as you look at it historically, it's also shaped not by these contradictions. Well, it and these contradictions are shaped by the political economic, the political economy, which shapes living conditions, access to needed resources, political consciousness, and the impact of these contradictions. So I've been looking at five periods that stand out, that parallel the development of the welfare state. They begin just before the turn of the century and end now, some 30 years after the post-war welfare state came under attack. So I have a few minutes. I'll try to speed through this. So the first one is what some people call the moral economy, which this is really prior to the development of the welfare state. Low-income women did demand lower rent, lower food prices, and so on, the things they needed to carry out their gendered obligation. They did it in their community. They protested against the high price of food and rent by leading food riots and rent strikes in Philadelphia, Boston, Chicago, Toronto, New York, and other places. Their protests reflected the lingering influence of European traditions, which held that members of the same ethnic group, who were their landlords and the food merchants and so on, violated the rules of this moral economy by overcharging their rent and overcharging them for rent and food. And so they got compelled to protest collectively to fulfill their gendered obligations. And it was interesting because these early confrontations exposed the inability of the market economy to adequately meet basic human needs and prefigured the goods and services that the government would eventually have to provide to sustain families, to ensure a healthy, productive, and properly socialized workforce, and of course to quiet social unrest. Then comes the consumer economy. I just tried to put these names on them to see if I could give it some meaning. So that's after World War I. The consumer economy replaces the moral economy. You have mass production, consumerism, which transfers housework, and also the image of the ideal middle-class woman changes. So there were enormous promises of consumerism. The promises of consumerism, the discrepancy between those promises and the rising cost of acquiring these new radios, refrigerators, the new household products, plus the growing gap between the rich and the poor, provoked new protests among low-income housewives and working women. And so there wasn't the welfare state then, so a national one. So they turned to local and state government and played a role during the Progressive Era reforms. Then comes the Depression economy, I'm saying 1928 to 45, which is a bit of a stretch, but anyway, it led individuals from all walks of life to take to the streets. In the 30s, women organized into separate women's locals, organized strikes, joined the CIO. Community-based homemakers supported strikes through union auxiliaries, consumer boycotts, blocked evictions, created a militant movement of housewives that conducted cost of living protests in cities nationwide. Black women organized Don't Buy Where You Can't Work campaigns in black communities and across the countries. Relief clients sat in welfare office in some in such cities as New York City. They became major actors in the unemployed councils, which are largely viewed as male populated. If you think of the crash in the 30s as the first crisis, economic crisis of the 20th century, the pressure of popular movements and spontaneous women's activism and so on, all this helped develop gave rise to the modern welfare state. Okay, I only have a minute left, so just to say quickly, the welfare state economy, all the programs that and all the social, the welfare state expanded enormously then due to a bunch of changes, but including the pressures of all the social movements that erupted during this period. But there wasn't much done until the 60s to mediate the tensions having to do with racism and classism. But low-income women continued their activism and were politicized and emboldened in part by some of these, by these changes and also by the welfare rights movement in the late 60s. So embedded in their protests was the demand that the market and the state meet their needs. In these protests, in the demands was even a more radical vision of what society could look like, one based on human rights. So then we have the neoliberal economy, which you're all familiar with. There are tons of books about it out in the hall there, in the bookstore. So we have what I call it the austerity economy, when all these all the gains of the movements and that benefited women, families, and communities will have been taken back, attacked, and so on. And so what you see now is women start to defend, getting active to defend the rights that their foremothers had won for them. So welfare rights initiative, the welfare rights movement, the Congress of Neighborhood Women in the 70s, this actually started in the 70s, and this has to be tracked. It's very inspiring to read about these case stories, and I'm very interested in documenting this because I think people forget about it if it's not known. But there would be no story to tell if it were not for the courage and stamina of the women themselves who longed for both bread and roses. They fought for the bread needed to carry out their gendered obligations, but the historical record shows they also fought for roses, that is, dignity, respect, and a better quality of life for themselves, their families, and their communities.